Welcome to Awakening Calls. Every Saturday, we host conversations with guest speakers from all walks of life. Speakers whose personal journeys awaken and inspire our innate spirit of service. Thank you for coming together to plant seeds for a more compassionate society.
For those of you that don't know Paul or are not familiar with his work, they say that, if you're out to make a change in the world, well, then Paul's an individual that you want to meet, because he can connect you to different people or ideas or organizations that can really make a difference. He's the founding president of the Social Venture Partners International and was the executive connector of SVP Seattle for the last 17 years. And so coming from that background, he has a very unique vantage point. And he's often considered a leading expert on activating social change agents and is considered a global thought leader on how individuals can be the most effective philanthropists. And Paul's committed to work in the community, and he's actually on the board of directors for SVPI and Partners for Our Children, which is a nonprofit based in the state of Washington that works to improve outcomes for vulnerable children and families. And in a previous life, Paul was actually in the private sector as well, and he was a group manager for worldwide operations at Microsoft and Nestle. And so, with this diverse background and an incredible set of experiences, we're really thankful to have Paul with us on the call today, and maybe he can help answer some of the questions, around our theme today. And so, Paul, thank you very much for joining us today. How are you?
I'm very good, Amma. Thank you, and thank you, Nipun.
Great. I was hoping you could start off by, I want to jump into our theme of today, but I was hoping you could actually start by just telling us a little bit about Social Venture Partners and then Social Venture Partners International, kind of what they do and how did you first get involved with them? Because I think it sets a nice context for, sort of the heart of our theme today.
Absolutely. Thanks for asking. So, Social Venture Partners, or SVP, was created in 1998, and we started in Seattle. And there's sort of a lot of mechanics I could describe about it, but at its root, SVP was sort of founded on the idea of people wanting to give back to their communities and not just wanting to give back with their money, which matters, but also with their time and their talents, their human and their intellectual as well as their financial capital. And the idea that also that doing that would be more powerful and more effective if you did it with other people, with a network of folks, certainly not unlike why you guys have created what you have in the way in which you've done it. So the sort of the core ideas underneath it were that people would want to be engaged in work in their community, and they would want to be connected to other people doing that like-minded work. So a little bit mechanically, what we do is we have individuals we started in Seattle, and individuals here would agree to commit a certain amount of financial money each year, which is sort of like the oil in our engine. And then we would collectively and in teams decide nonprofits in the community, education and environmentally focused nonprofits to give grants to, but then also sit down with them and say, how can we help you build your organization? How can we help you build your capacity to become a stronger organization? And then create working relationships together between sort of civically, philanthropically minded investors, if you will, and nonprofit social sector leaders, and create long-term relationships to help strengthen organizations. And by doing that, number one, not only do we hopefully sometimes help nonprofits get stronger, but what happens, number two, is all the people that get involved in that, they become stronger. By investing yourself, and I'm sure a lot of the folks on the call know this, by investing yourself in the community and investing not just your money, but your time and your talents in the community, you learn as much about yourself. You get as much, if not more, back from that experience as you give to it. So it really, at the sort of simplest level, that's what SVP is and that's what we do. And the idea was in Seattle originally. A guy from Phoenix called us in 1999. Another individual called us from Vancouver in 2000. And what we thought was a good idea for Seattle, we found out was a good idea for other places around North America. And we decided to figure out what we could do together collectively that we couldn't do on our own across North America. And then about 4 or 5 years ago, people started contacting us from other parts of the world. So we now have 40 SCP groups, chapters, whatever you want to call them, in 9 countries around the world: U.S., Canada, Japan, Korea, China, Australia, India, U.K., and Brazil as of late last year. So what's really neat about that is not just that, say, we, you know, built some empire. Who cares about that? But what's really fascinating is some of those core ideas I described to you, Amit, they cut across culture, they cut across geography, they literally cut across the entire world. And there are many things that make us different across the world, and yet there are also things that sort of at a deeper, simpler human level make us all very similar across the world. So that's SVP in sort of the 2-minute version.
Thank you. I appreciate that. One of the things that you had just mentioned was that, you know, you ask for individuals to commit financial resources, but more importantly, their time. And you know, so often when we talk about giving, you know, often, and whether it's in corporate, like America, or just in conversations at people's homes or whatnot, it's so often initially just talk about it financially. And so I would really, you know, I would love for you to share a story of an individual that, you know, came from a world where, you know, giving was just really just about writing the check and sort of the honor or the ego that kind of comes with that, and then really seeing their transformation from getting involved with an organization and how it really changed or affected them.
Sure. So what I'll say about, I think we all know this in our daily lives. I mean, money is always necessary. It's never sufficient. So it makes it sort of greases the engine, but it never makes the car go. Lots of metaphors we could use for this. So I don't want to, you know, for example, when we work with nonprofits, I don't want to underestimate that money matters. But what we find, and I think everybody finds in their lives, is you can throw all the money at the world at something, but if you don't have the right people and the right spirit and the right heart and the right talents around that money, it isn't going to go very far. So my work for 17 years being the director of the group in Seattle, as well as they gave me the title founding president of the network, which basically meant we screwed everything up so we could share our knowledge with the other 39 cities. So much of my experience was about working with individuals, and some of them are folks you call philanthropists. Some of them are what you call nonprofit leaders. Some of them are what you call civically engaged citizens. And one of the powerful things about this work, when people really get engaged in it, is those titles and those sort of silos and those identifiers that we sort of live by start to bleed away, and everybody becomes a change agent. Everybody becomes a change maker that just sort of brings different things to the table of change, whatever that cause or whatever the organization is that you're trying to affect. So my point was about how money is always necessary. It's never sufficient. And you asked me to sort of convey a story of a person that represented that. And the first individual that's in the book that I wrote, his name's David Risher. He was a guy that I happened to know from Microsoft. And David was a guy that growing up, he didn't grow up with much. He will tell you that books and reading were his way out of poverty. So many, many years later in his life, he was doing some giving. He was doing some volunteering in his community. But he went on a trip with his family, and they were in another part of the world in an orphanage doing some volunteer work. And without going through all the complicated details, he sort of realized that the students of this orphanage didn't have access to the library because the library was locked and nobody had the key. And what that did for him is it really triggered something inside of David that reminded him of what made a difference for him growing up. And so what David decided to do was to sort of, you know, sometimes we have these epiphanies in life that really, you know, flip the switch for us. Other folks, it's sort of a long journey. For David, he really had one of those sort of flip moments. And what he decided to do was commit himself to helping to reduce and hopefully someday eradicate illiteracy around the world. And he created an organization called World Reader. They needed money to get World Reader started. But what made the difference was not the money. What made the difference was David's passion, his commitment, the networks that he had, the people that he connected to, and everybody involved with it that was willing to do what it took to take a little seed of an idea and to make it grow. And again, money sort of got the engine started, but what makes the engine grow, what makes the idea grow, is their talents and their professional skills and their human skills and their just good old passion and commitment that make a small idea continue to grow and to grow and to grow So the idea I would leave with folks about, you know, money is don't ever underestimate it. We all know that it matters in our lives. It makes certain things possible, and it's also almost never sufficient. So my apologies for the choppy answer there, but let's go from there.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it. So, you know, speaking of, I guess, sort of calling, how did, you know, what was your calling into this line of work? I mean, you know, you were working in the private sector and all of a sudden made somewhat what would seem a large shift. And so what led you to this?
Great question, Amit. You know, I would be a great example of a person that didn't have, you know, one moment where the switch flipped. You know, for David, he had this literally epiphanous moment. For me, I grew up, my dad was a minister, and so I was around the church. And, you know, certainly he lived a life of service, and we did all kinds of things when I was growing up as a junior high and a high school age kid, and I did some of it because I wanted to, and I did some of it because I had to because my dad was the minister. I think there's some things that I sort of learned that sort of stuck with me. So all those years later in my life, when I had worked at Nestle and a startup and then Microsoft for a little while, I sort of had this, you know, thing where you realize you're so heads down about what you're working on. Hey, why don't you look left and right rather than just, you know, straight ahead for a few minutes and sort of start to check out the community. And I did a little bit of that. And then in my case, I really was lucky enough in 98 to have a handful of other people that came along and sort of collectively came up with the idea for SVP. And what was really powerful about it for me was, again, those ideas of not just using your money, but using your time and skills, and not just doing this by myself, but doing it with other people. And so that idea clicked for me, and I decided to sort of make a jump. And I made the jump because of those other people. Everything, most of the choices that I make as I go along in my life, it's more and more about the people that I can be connected to. Give me the right five people to be around, and I'll take that over $1 billion any day of the week because the five of us will figure it out and we'll make it right. So it was the right handful of people to work with. And so that sort of got me headed down a path on it, but it took me many years of sort of working with people. And I think, you know, some sort of, you know, little bits of connection back to who I was and what I did growing up. And what I finally came to realize was that the one of the places that I could really add value in the world was working with, talking with, listening to, understanding other people and what their sort of challenges were in life and where they wanted to create positive change and where they wanted to commit to a cause and to helping them find that pathway to doing it. And obviously that's part of what led me to the book as well. But I think if I have a can't not do now, it's helping people recognize, realize their potential and to help them find that pathway to create positive change in the world. And when I say those words out loud, I can hear how they can sound, you know, a little bit highfalutin, they could sound arrogant. And so I better really believe it. I better really mean it. But on the other side of it, I don't want to be afraid of that. Every one of us on this call, every one of us has a gift. We have things that we do well, things we don't do well. So I'm trying to sort of identify what my gift is, own it, use it humbly, wisely, but as powerfully as I possibly can to create positive change in the world. So I have my responsibility for what I can do myself, but I hope that I can be leveraged by helping other folks find that potential and find that sense of pathway themselves as well.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. You know, Paul, I guess, you know, so from that, and this leads us perfectly into your book, right? And I think, you know, and also our theme today of can't not do, because you're right. I do believe that, you know, everyone has gifts and certain talents, but not necessarily, may not have some of the clarity to sort of move in a direction right toward a specific cause, right? And so, you know, we ask ourselves, well, can I really make a difference on this cause? Or, you know, this problem's really way too big. How can just one person, and I don't have fame or fortune, how can I even begin to tackle it? And so I think it would be interesting to hear sort of your take or the process, actually, that you lead individuals through so they can help address those fears their own internal barriers and then work towards whatever their passion may be.
Great. Well, let me give that a start, and then we'll keep the conversation going, and I look forward to everybody's questions as well. So what I started to do a couple of years ago, I'd been up to this work for about 15 years, and some folks would sort of along the way say, gee, you should write about this, and I sort of thought that's baloney. But what I did finally decide to do was listen. And so I started to sit down, I don't know, 3 years ago, and have a conversation just like this with those people that I had come across, whether you call them philanthropists or whether they're nonprofit leaders or whether they're volunteers, you know, all these walks of life and all these different roles they play, and sort of who are some of the people that I thought really had shown that commitment and that passion and that perseverance, and who, you know, from what I could observe anyway, who did I think had really created some positive impact? Maybe it was in their neighborhood, maybe it was in the city, maybe it was around the world. You know, who created impact? And just start talking to them and listening to those folks. And so that's what I did. And you know, 6 months later, there were some themes that really emerged for me. And I think what I'd done for the previous 14 or so years and still do is I have a conversation, and every one of them is unique to the person. And yet there's a little bit of a skeleton, if you will, to it. I think there's somewhat of a pathway that I tried to reverse engineer, if you will, out of those conversations to share back in the form of that book, and how I talk to people that might help folks sort of find that pathway, because it can feel very amorphous. It can feel sort of, you know, broad. It can feel imposing. Well, how do I have an impact? And so the way that I wrote the book was to try to give, sort of walk through a series of 7 questions. And, you know, again, rather than say, do this, do that, the asking of questions as opposed to giving answers, that's an important just way that I framed the book. Because I think the right question is more powerful than, you know, 100 answers. It makes us each think about and own the question for ourselves. And so through those 7 questions, Amit, the first 3 really sort of get at how do you find that sort of focus and how do you find that direction. The next 3 questions are about how do you show up to do this work and what do I think makes you effective and powerful in doing that work. And the last one is sort of rolling it all together to say how do you sort of put all that together and identify what is your can't not do. So that's the way I organize the book, is helping folks find that focus, helping identify to think about how they show up to do this work, and then sort of roll it all together and embark, if you will, with a sense of purpose and direction. So that's, I'll go as deep into any of that as you want me to or not, but that's sort of the way I organized it. And the idea, again, is to help folks find that pathway. And the pathway that I lay out and sort of the guide path, if you will, that I give to folks is based on all these folks that I've worked with all these years and the ones that I felt like were the most sort of impactful and the ones that did it, I think, with the most integrity in how they approached their work in the world.
You know, I think what would be lovely is to hear some stories of some of these incredible individuals that you've worked with. And what might be nice is to maybe hear a couple of them, but in different social, local, or global contexts. Because, I loved how you said at the beginning that, you know, regardless of culture or country, there was so much commonality despite a lot of the differences that we may perceive from the outside. And so I think it'd be great to sort of be able to weave that together.
Okay. That's not a small question. I'll give you 2 people. First one's a woman named Lisa Chin. And these are both folks that I work with in SCP. Lisa Chin was an individual, sort of had a pathway like mine in life. That was ready for a sort of hit an inflection point in her career and was trying to figure out what was it that she would, you know, go to work on in the community. And she did a lot of looking around. She did a lot of thinking, and somewhat connected to who she was growing up. And also in her case, somewhat connected to, the experience of going through the birth of her baby boy. And the theme that sort of emerged out of all that for Lisa was the idea of empowerment and that in the course of her life, she'd had, you know, hard moments and positive moments. And she thought what the difference maker for her was either when she found it in herself or somebody around her that helped her feel empowered to do more and to achieve more and to get more done in the world. So the idea, the sort of the core thread for her in her life was about empowerment. And she, at, you know, through SCP, what she did was, and one of the things I tell everybody is, you know, start somewhere, you know, plant a seed, go do a volunteer project. Boy, I sure did in Los Angeles 25 years ago. I went to a volunteer project on the weekend and just had the experience, just got my feet and my, you know, wet and got involved in it. And Lisa did that in a handful of places. And then she came across an organization called Year Up, which is about empowering high school age kids that are graduating from high school. They're sort of on that precipice of you know, getting on the path to a career or college, or, you know, falling off the side and going down the wrong pathway in life. And Year Up's work is about helping these kids find a positive pathway in life. And so for Lisa, the question in the book that she is the person that answers is, who are you at your core? Those first three questions that I think are really important are, what are you a determined optimist about? Who are you at your core? And what are you willing to walk through hard places for? And there's a lot of depth to each one of those questions. But those three questions to me are things that I heard a lot of people say to me out loud or that I could sort of interpret. They helped somebody find that focus and find that direction. So for Lisa, what I know she is a determined optimist about is the potential of young people in the world. And what she is committed to is helping them find that sense of empowerment. And the notion of walking through hard places every day in the course of her work, she comes across kids that are in dark spots or dark places in their life. And she has to sort of get in there with them and help them work through those places in her life. So Lisa's very much the embodiment of that idea. Another guy is a guy by the name of Paul Gross. He's a friend. 10 years ago, he and his wife, Lori, had their first child. His name was William. And having had three kids myself, he went through, you know, the experience any parent just dreads. You know, you got a little daughter, I got three boys. The thought of having, you know, your child be unhealthy or have something go really wrong right from the get-go is just, it's the worst possible thought in life. His son William spent the first month of his life in ICU, in intensive care, and he had a condition that was, it's called hydrocephalus, which is, in simple terms, water on the brain. But in infant, when that condition exists, it can cause, you know, swelling of the brain. It can cause brain damage. It can lead to death. And those first hours, those first days of life are so critical. And they were able to get their son William through it. The sort of clinical procedure is really inserting a shunt in their brain to drain the fluid. And sometimes it succeeds, sometimes it doesn't. There's complications, et cetera, et cetera. Well, they finally got William healthy. You know, he's a 10-year-old boy today. He's got some challenges, but for the most part, he's got a positive potential in life. Well, after he and his wife, Lori, went through that, they, another way of sort of, you know, saying, do you have a can not do? They had this itch to scratch. They thought about what the experience they went through and thought, my God, so many people go through this, you know, thousands and thousands of parents every year go through the experience. Well, what can we learn about this? And the research they did, at first it was discouraging because what they found was the science around hydrocephalus really had not advanced much in 50 years. And so, you know, Paul's a great example of, you know, it took him a while to sort of get to this point. And in his case, a negative thing led to a positive event in life. But through his research, he said, you know, how can we be this place in the years, you know, then it was 2006, where the science in our world is so advanced in some places, but not in this particular condition, this particular disease. And he became an advocate. And what he found was that the work to do research on this, and this is true of a lot of medical challenges, sort of exists in silos, and it's individual researchers doing individual work in different places around the world. And a lot of times that work doesn't get connected. And what he believed was you know, individual people had answers, but people didn't put all the answers together. And we probably all have experiences in our life where we're familiar with silos and people that work in silos. Each one of us are that sometimes. And the answers are out there, but we just need to get them. And, you know, there's a lot more complexity to how Paul did it. But in the essence, that's what he did, was he connected the people that did this work and said, hey, we can make 1 + 1 + 1 = 10 here, not just 3, you know, we can, the whole can be read as some of its parts. And through a number of years of advocacy and hard work and connecting and pushing and prodding, he finally got sort of the players and the actors that knew the answers to get better connected to each other. So there's now tests and procedures for hydrocephalus that are making a significant difference in the identification, prevention, and treatment of kids that have that condition from an early stage in life. And I think the resonant idea in Paul's and Lori's life was the idea of, they just could not stand the thought of something happening to someone else's kid that had happened to their kid that they had to go through. And that conviction, that can't not do, is what drove them for many years to try to make a difference for thousands of kids downstream now that will benefit from this, that will never know William, that will never know Paul, but they will live a different life and their child will live a different life because of the passion and commitment they showed. So Lisa and Paul to me are two really great exemplars of some of the principles in the book.
And going, Paul, it seems to me that, you know, in all these stories like Paul's and Lisa, there's so many of these stories you highlight in the book as well, these change makers are going up against a lot of odds. And one of the questions you ask about, or you ask change makers to hold, is, you know, are you a determined optimist, or how can you be a determined optimist? And, yep. And what I like about the determined part in there is that it kind of makes it longitudinal, you know, that it's not just in that moment, but can you stay optimistic despite the odds? So in working with all these change makers, have you noticed certain traits or certain sort of best practices that they use to sort of continue to rise up against the sort of negativity that comes up their way, or even just within us, or just feeling fatigued, or just feeling like, wow, this is too big of a problem, and that carries them over to this sort of mountaintop?
Yeah, great question. And, you know, we don't all reach the mountaintop. sometimes some of us push the boulder up the hill, right? And maybe someday later, somebody else will be the person that will sort of literally get to the mountaintop and push that boulder over the hill down the other side.
Very true.
It's a great question, Nipun. Let me answer it in two ways. First of all, is to sort of break down this idea of determined and optimist. And those are not overly complicated ideas, but it's a combination that really matters. There's things in life that we may each feel determined about, but eventually, you know, that can become a drudge, or we can get sort of beaten down if we don't also have a sense of optimism or possibility about it. If all we feel about it is optimism, you know, at some point in time, when the going gets tough, we may say that something, it's important and I care about it, but Jesus is getting hard now, so I'm going to bail out. So it's the idea of finding something that meets both of those characteristics. And those other two initial questions I just described, which is, who are you at your core? And what are you willing to go through hard places for? Those two questions feed back to that first. All these questions feed on each other. But if you sort of, you know, think about my quick story about David Risher, why would he endeavor to want to take on something like, you know, illiteracy in the third world? So hard, so challenging. Well, part of it was because who David is at his core is a reader. Every one of us is some core of who we are in our life, and maybe we don't spend the time to think about it. And if we sort of really take a little bit of time to dig deep, we'll find out who we are at our core, and that will help us lead to what we might be a determined optimist about. So that's just a little bit more about that first question in the book, which I appreciate you're asking about. Common trait. I don't know if you, either you're asking this independently, which has happened to me many, many times, or maybe you've seen me write about this somewhere else of late, because when I ran around this fall talking about the book, I was probably in 15 different cities and talked to all kinds of different groups. And literally, that is the single question that I got asked by far the most.
Really?
I think the first time I got asked, oh, yeah. It happens every, I don't prompt it. It happens every other place I go. I think the first was Boston and Boulder. But it gets asked a lot. And the book is sort of structured around 7 questions. And, you know, how do you go deep on each one of those? And I think people are asking, well, can you simplify that for me? Give me one thing that sort of cuts across all those things. It's a very natural, good question. And the first time I asked it, I didn't have the FAQ ready, but the answer was very natural for me. And the answer to that question was grit. maybe some of your listeners, maybe you guys, there's a professor at Pennsylvania in the last few years. Her name's Angela Duckworth. She did a TED talk on grit. She wrote a book about it, and she has definitely made sort of a science out of it. And the way she defines grit is the passion and perseverance to pursue long-term goals. And every one of those words in there, passion, perseverance, long-term goal, every one of those has a meaning, and the combination of those is what makes grit. What Duckworth originally was trying to study is why do some kids, you know, in impoverished areas of communities, why do some kids make it and some kids don't? And she looked at socioeconomic factors. She looked at academic factors. She looked at all these different factors, and she didn't walk in with a preconception, but what she walked out with was the notion that if you could identify in which of these kids had a greater, deeper sense of grit, either inborn or taught or learned, however it happened, the kid that had that characteristic, that trait, that was the kid that had more chance to make it. So that characteristic and that trait in these people, she applied it to students and kids, and I'm applying to change agents, change makers, but that quality of grit, the passion and perseverance to pursue goals for the long term, that absolutely is the most common characteristic that I can say cuts across all those people. And there's all kinds of things I think that go into grit. It's a good term. It's an evocative term. It sort of says something to you when you say the words out loud, and then when you use that definition in the way that Duckworth sort of expands upon it. I love the idea of it. I can't probably help but reflect a little bit of myself into the book and hopefully not impose my thinking. But when I think about myself in life, I was born into, I've been so lucky. I was born into a middle-class family, you know, was able to go to not fantastic, but have decent education. You know, I'm relatively intelligent. I'm far from a genius, but I've got, you know, the basics. And I think what makes the difference to me in life is that I will outwork somebody and I'll persevere more. And those things, I think, make the most difference in the people that I came across in the course of my work as well.
Yeah, that's really interesting because I know you're a sports fan, and I used to want to go pro in tennis, and so sports was a big part of me. And so grit was, you know, that's like anyone who's been serious about sports, it kind of has, it learns grit. And to apply that to social change to me has always been like a very, you know, I think it's been a very present practice. And so it's great to hear that it's, you know, you're finding that too across all your work.
We all have talents and potential, and there's a, you know, there's all kinds of sayings out there about it, but at the end of the day, at whatever level we get to in life, I mean, the thing that really does make the difference at some point in time is who will work a little bit harder, who's a little bit more committed, who will put in a few extra hours, who will, you know, stick with it when the going gets tough, all kinds of metaphors, all kinds of pithy sayings. But I really do think it is, you know, it's sort of like, again, it's like money. It's nice to have money. It's good to have money, but money doesn't make the difference. What makes the difference is what do you do with it? What do you do on top of the money? So the idea of grit to me just says it's that extra, it's that can't not do factor in life that makes a difference.
Totally.
That's great. You know, actually, I was hoping, Paul, that you could actually reflect in it in terms of your own life. You know, if you take a look at, you know, you take a look at this idea of grit, right? And you talk about these social change agents, and I'm sure early on when they're facing on some of these causes, it's going to require a tremendous amount of grit. But I almost feel that with anything over, you know, an extended period of time, hopefully we're gaining a certain level of wisdom in the way that we're approaching our cause, but more specifically, the way that we are gauging ourselves internally and holding, you know, whether it's a certain level of equanimity or the way we approach. And so I'm curious what your own internal journey has been and in terms of approaching others and how you have stayed a determined optimist, if you would even consider yourself one.
Well, that's a great question. Well, so it's a wonderful, good question, and I thought about it before our call a little bit. You know, when I think about myself and my own internal journey, what I said to you was that I've been born with and had really everything anybody could sort of want in life. I wasn't born into riches. I wasn't whatever, but I had everything I needed. I didn't lack for anything that I need in life. And yet, I probably, like everybody, I've had so many places in life where there's a sense, you know, you hit these sort of little mountains you create for yourself of fear. And fear is the thing that holds more of us back than anything. And fear comes from many, many places, sometimes very, very valid. And sometimes in the cases of people like me, just invented, perceived, irrational. You know, you put up a barrier for yourself. I can't pass this test. I can't get into this college. I can't get that job. I can't, you know, whatever the case it is. And I don't know that I can say where I learned this, but for me, I do have those moments where I, you know, I wake up in the middle of the night and I just, you know, I feel like I can't do it. And the thing that has made the difference for me so many times in my life is at some point in time, however metaphorically you want to think of this, you just have to sort of stare fear in the face and then, you know, give it a good punch or step back, be silent and let that fear melt away. Whatever you're, you know, whatever works for you. I'm probably a little bit more of a punch it out kind of person than a let it melt away person. I should be more the latter than the former, but whatever approach works for you, there are these moments in life where you've got to find that grit. You've got to find that perseverance and you've got to overcome. So I'll say for me, so many times in my life, I think that's how I got, it wasn't because I was smarter. I don't think it was because I, sure the heck wasn't because I was richer. It wasn't because I was, I don't know, a faster runner, what even I call it. It was because at some point in time, you sort of summon the grit, you summon the courage to just sort of push on through. You don't know that you're going to succeed. You just do, you just go, you just start. You know, the ultimate example of that, I know you can identify with this because you talked about your little daughter up front. When you have a family, when you have kids, you may not know it, but you just signed up for a lot of grit. you sign up for the biggest challenge in the world. And like you said, you know, what sort of can't not do resonates for you. There's nothing you wouldn't do for your little daughter. And any of us that are parents, you know, there's nothing we wouldn't do for our kids. And there's probably no feeling like that in the world. And when I talk about can't not do, I know people can't reach quite that level of commitment. That feeling, that sort of directionally, that sense of commitment, that sense of, you know, I would give my life for my kid. You know, that's sort of the idea that I want to evoke for people. You know, can you sort of discover that? Again, you can't feel the same way you feel about, you know, your child. That's probably the ultimate feeling you ever feel. But in that direction, down that pathway, what's the cause, the sense of purpose, the sense of direction in life that you sort of begins to evoke that thing that you can't not do? And I have three boys. They couldn't be any more different. Every one of them has gifts. Every one of them has challenges. And I think for me, being a dad, being a halfway good dad, is probably the biggest challenge I've ever had in my life. I am way better at my work than I am at being a dad. And yet I will never sort of give up on trying to be as good at that as I can possibly be, you know, recognizing that nothing humbles you, nothing brings you back down to earth like having kids does. So, it's been an ever-present theme in my life. I don't know that I could put the word grit on it. Having somebody like Duckworth come along lets you sort of put a label on something, which is nice. And it shows up in lots of little places, you know, every day in my life. And it shows up without a doubt in big places like having kids and how do you raise kids and how do you persevere? You know, sometimes you got to be the one that heads off to college and heads off to school and your kid got in trouble and you don't have any choice. You got to go see the principal. So those are those moments that sort of you come across in life. So yeah, grit's been very ever present in my life. And that notion of overcoming your fears is really a resonant theme for me.
And are there any things that in your life that you've used aside from grit to overcome your fears? Are there inspirations that you've looked upon that help you sometimes get over that hunch, or things, practices that you do in your daily life that allow you to move in that direction?
Yeah, wonderful question. You know, I think I probably should practice meditation more. I don't enough. The flip side of that is exercise matters. So I try to make sure that I continue to exercise, not just for physical wellness, but absolutely for mental wellness. That makes a big difference. Sometimes when I'm feeling down, you just need to make your blood pump for an hour. And that has all kinds of good positive benefits. Another part that's really important for me is the people I surround myself with. I briefly referenced her in the book. I found the right person to marry, and I'm still with her, doing better than ever. And having other people to go talk to and to share that with, I think we definitely take ourselves down the pathway of fear much more significantly, much more severely, when we let ourselves get closed in and sort of close the door and let us think about and work on the problem ourselves, instead of opening ourselves up to others to listen to us, to hear us, you know, to reflect back to us, to make us realize that the mountain's not quite as high as we thought it was, to make us realize that our fear is sometimes partly, at least, not grounded. And all those things, I think, make a difference in helping you lead a more positive life.
That resonates so strongly with me, Paul. I mean, what stands out to me is it seems so in line with what so many other, you know, difference makers that I've been fortunate enough to meet in my life also say. I met a spiritual teacher from India at one point, and, you know, we were having this a discussion on what does it mean to be a true change maker. How can I dedicate my life to service? He's like, it's simple, and and his belief was keep things simple. And he said, you know, you have to serve others as selflessly as you can. You have to serve yourself, meaning, you know, doing practices to take care of your health, your physical well-being, and your mental well-being, and meditation, things like that. And then you just have to surround yourself with good people, the right people. And so I really appreciate your answer, because it very much speaks to that understanding that so many of the change makers have a deep belief in.
Fantastic. And let me just interject here, and Amit, I just wanted to remind everybody that we have opened up the call queue, so if you'd like to speak to Paul or share a comment or a question, hit *6 if you're dialed in. If you are listening to the live stream online, and you can email us at askask@servicespace.org, or you can just fill out the form over there. We have a bunch of comments already, and we'll definitely be reading those out. But Amit, I'll go to you to just close out your conversation before we head into the more popcorn style Q&A.
Well, I'm hoping to squeeze one in at the end there as well, a couple of questions. But, you know, a question I do love asking folks that are working, you know, in the field that you do is, you know, there's often this question of making an impact, but how do you measure that impact? What's the best way to measure impact, to measure change? And I often think back, I was with my old college roommate, and we were sitting down just like having this discussion that, okay, well, impact really means the breadth or the depth of impact that you make. So it doesn't matter if it's 1,000 people, but, you know, as long as you go deep, you know, into someone, you can change even just one life, that's making a change. Whereas other people will measure it. No, you know, if I can feed 1,000,000 people, then that's really making a change. And that's what impact really means. So I'm curious what your take is on what does meaningful change look like.
Boy, that's one of the holy grail questions, you know.
it's a great one.
Yeah. Well, let me answer from two directions. The first direction is from ourselves, sort of inward looking out. And I think each one of us has to define and decide what impact means to each of us. And to some degree, what the book is about, what the idea of Can't Not Do, is about helping you identify what's that thing that you want to have an impact on, and then go deep into it. So I think as you go out into the world, it matters to identify the thing that matters to you, and whether that means to you go deep or go broad, you know, I think it's impossible for any one of us to sort of say, well, this is the right way, this is the wrong way. Seriously, both of those answers are correct. What I would say is whichever answer you sort of decide for yourself, commit. And then go do the most you can to create a breadth or a depth of impact. If your definition of impact is to help one foster kid for the next 10 years of your life, and you do that incredibly well, who in the world can say that's not huge impact, right? And on the other hand, if your goal is that I want to be a part of an organization that's going to reach thousands of people in a particular way, and you commit yourself to doing that work in a purposeful way, who am I to say that's any more or less impactful? So I think the first part of it is to try to define for yourself what does impact mean, because you've got to commit to something that matters to you. You've got to be connected to something that gives you a sense of impact, a sense of purposefulness. The second part of the answer, sort of outside looking in, if you will, is there are so many causes in the world that are challenging that matter. And I can't tell someone that arts matters more than the environment, that matters more than youth development, matters more than, you know, gang violence. All of those are really important challenging issues. And having spent some time in the private sector, I'm sure some of the callers do too, you spend both times in both sectors, and one things you learn that's sort of quote beautiful unquote about the private sector is you do have this one thing called profit, which is a clear goal. Not the only goal, but it's a clear one. And you also have this thing called a customer that buys your product. And those two things really help sort of guide the direction of organization. And sometimes in social change work, you don't have those two beacons. Again, they're not the be-all, end-all, but they're clear. And you don't have those things to sometimes guide the work. So I think the sort of outside-in answer, the sort of out in the world, what does impact and change mean, it's a really hard, complex answer. And it's not as black and white as did we make money or did we not make money. So if I'm trying to help, you know, reduce gang violence, well, how do I measure that? What are the indicators of that? There's lots of different ways to measure it. But what I think sort of comes into play there is what is or if you're going to invest in an organization, sort of what's their theory or their logic of change about how they're trying to create change in the world. So how does someone say, I'm trying to create better academic outcomes? Does it make sense? Does it have a logic to it? And try to discern, are you investing your passion, your time into something that has a pathway to creating change? Again, it's hard because there isn't that one sort of specific indicator like profit. But on the other hand, there are indicators that say, are we helping kids live better lives? Are we helping families live better lives? Are communities thriving? And we can point to things, and we should at least be diligent about what organizations and what commitments represent a place where I do believe they're having impact in our community and the world. Good question.
That's great. Thank you. Thank you, Amit, and thank you for your beautiful responses. Paul, we have a comment from Andrea in North Carolina, and I quote, interestingly, my son was born in 1989 with hydrocephalus. Like Paul and Lori, I was thrust into an area I never knew existed. My efforts to steer my son Justin through the confusing and chaotic service system so he could maximize his potential was a lengthy and taxing endeavor. Ultimately, he graduated from an inclusive integrated secondary education at UNC Greensboro. Unfortunately, Justin met his demise in September 2014 due to shunt failure. This has propelled me, second time in my life, to learn more about social capital and building community capacity. After all these years, I continue to struggle with how to make this happen in my local community. I've followed Al Condalucci's work for over 10 years and still feel as if we are very good at talking about making a change. I simply do not know how to be that pivotal change. So this is not really a question, simply my story, end quote. I would lay that up into something, Paul. I heard you, or rather I read this week, one of our portals, dailygood.org, featured one of your articles, and you opened that with the story of the Empire State Building, and you said,
yeah,
hey, look, you know, the most revolutionary change there wasn't the architecture or the height. You know, there were two other buildings nearby that were just as high. But the big deal with the Empire State Building was in the construction practices, in how the building was framed, and that's what allowed them to do it the way they did it and as fast as they did it. So Maybe that kind of, you know, both of those together, just some tips on how we can be that pivotal change, as Andrea was alluding to.
Well, two thoughts on that. First of all, Andrea, if you're still listening, as it to anybody, my email now is shoe, like the thing on her foot, at paulshoemaker.org. And Andrea, if you send me a note, I will connect you to Paul and understand a little bit better about what you're up to and what you're working on. Your story just, oh God, that just shows, that's hard to listen to. You have my heart. And then to your sort of your metaphor there in that story that I wrote about, the point that I would apply to this case was, and one of the points I was trying to make in that article was about sometimes change is the, some folks think it needs to be the big, obvious, architectural, beautiful, sexy ideas in the world. And sometimes what really makes a difference, though, is not that. It's the scaffolding. It's the guts. It's the less sexy stuff. It's the mechanics. It's the boring stuff that actually makes more difference, has more leverage. So, you know, when folks think about creating change, you know, one way we talk about this is don't think you got to boil the ocean, you know, help one kid. Don't think you got to help every kid. If you want to help one kid, that's really powerful. And another part of this is that sometimes change is really big and significant and powerful and public and exciting. And sometimes the most important change that happens is, you know, away from the stage, the less sexy, less sort of, you know, important sounding stuff that really makes a difference down the foundation, how the engine works, you know, not the flashy exterior stuff. But that's really powerful, Andrea. Thank you for sharing that.
Great. We have a couple callers calling in audio form, so we'll go to them next.
Hi, this is Netika. I was going to ask a different question, but after hearing the last exchange, I want to ask a different question. Taking the lead from Andrea and all your response is, and also what Amit mentioned earlier about how do leaders in as change agents, you know, work from a place of wisdom, from a place of compassionate wisdom. You know, we the journey starts from whether you want to help a child, and it could move towards just helping that child, and that's very good enough, or it could move towards an organization and doing things more system-wide. Along the way, there are, you know, it's an empathy journey of ups and downs, and like you said, to keep the resilience, to keep the grit, to persevere. What in your mind are the tools to have that resiliency, but again, to come back from a place of compassion and wisdom rather than anger? And secondly, I'm also interested in understanding your thoughts on collective impact. A lot of the work in this space is really, you know, impact measurement and impact investing, and all of this is kind of gaining ground, but it's pretty siloed still. And I'm interested to understand your thoughts on how you see your role in thought leadership for pushing that idea about collective impact, whether it is through a region or through a particular cause.
Okay. Two wonderful different questions. Let me obviously take them one at a time. So on the first one, as far as tools go, in a way you gave me a great segue to the second set of three questions in the book, which are, I think, are about how you show up to do the work. And in part, they might respond to your question of how do you do it with compassion? How do you do it with wisdom? And the fourth, fifth, and sixth questions I ask in the book are, can you be an active listener? Are you willing, are you ready to be humble and humbled with a D on the end? And do you believe 1 + 1 = 3, which is the idea of being a connector? And the tools that I found, and I think this is really relevant to the year and the time we live in, and it's the power of listening, it's the value of authentic, genuine humility, and it's practicing that idea of being a connector. And I find those three traits, those three practices, those, whatever you want to call them, I find those three things to be very, very leveraged in the world we live in today. So you could, you know, sort of say have a vision or, you know, be a big idea, be a big thinker. You know, the things help, they matter. But I really find what makes a difference for individual people and gives them positive power is how significant and how strong of a listener they are. You know, we all know the experience of being listened to well. It's an incredibly empowering experience. And the value of listening, I think, is massively underestimated. And I hope everybody, a lot of folks probably that are on this call by nature, you already believe in that idea. I think humility, practicing it authentically, genuinely, is a little bit challenging because it's sort of easy to say I'm humble. And I describe in the book a friend of mine that sort of called me on my own definition of humility and sort of shot me down and said, hey, your humility really isn't as genuine and authentic as you maybe think it is. And she really called me to task in a really hard and really powerful way. But I think genuine, authentic humility is something that people can feel. People want to be around. People want to be a part of. They want to respond to it. They want to calls them to action. And then this idea of being a connector, this isn't rocket science. We live in this incredibly hyper-connected world, and we all know the positive and the negative of networks and social media, et cetera. And that networks and connectedness can be used for good. And so I think what I try to talk about in the book is just not talk about it as a general concept, but get some very specific ways in which we each can be a better, more powerful connector and how important that is and how leveraged that is in the world today. So to answer your first question, as far as tools that I think will help us each build wisdom and help build that sense of compassion, I think humility, listening, and connectedness would be my sort of answer to that. And the second one is about collective impact. And some of you on this call probably heard that phrase, other folks haven't. It's just real quick context. It's sort of a movement going on in the social sector these days. And my sort of broad layman's definition of it would be that the social challenges in our communities are not going to be solved by one sector, private, public, or nonprofit by itself. It's not going to be solved by one organization by itself. It also, I think, says sort of implicitly or explicitly, we have, at least in America, we have a lot of resources. And sometimes our problem isn't having enough, it's how we apply them. And that there are a lot of solutions out there that exist. There's organizations that do good work and other folks that don't do as good work, but there's organizations out there that really do know how to solve social problems. So if you put that set of factors together, the one of the conclusions you could come to is the problem is we don't put the parts and pieces together in a collective way, in an organized way, enough in a sustained way to create change in a community. So collective impact is sort of a frame that's giving to this idea, this movement in many communities around the country. And if you Google collective impact, you'll get lots of articles about it. And there was one that was written in the Stanford Innovation Review 3 or 4 years ago that sort of frames the whole idea up and gives it a set of principles that sort of identifies what is collective impact and what does it mean. But I think the idea of collective impact, you know, some folks might say, hey, that's just system change. And that's, you know, I've been thinking about system change for all my life. To some degree, that's true. It's a little bit of an updated frame around the idea that none of us can solve the problem on our own, a belief that solutions and resources are out there. It's just a matter of putting them together in the right way and doing it, again, over the sustained for the long term, doing it with grip, sticking with it through the hard times, and really persevering to create change. And if you, there's a collective impact movement, there's organizations around there, there's examples. The sort of originating one was an organization called Strive Together in Cincinnati. And it was about the whole community coming together around academic and behavioral and life success for kids in the greater Cincinnati area. And they're beginning to see some really positive direction. And it took everybody coming together in a structured, intentional way to create change. So collective impact, there's lots of folks that do it well, don't do it so well, but as a general idea, as a general concept, I think it's got real potential for the future, yes. So long-winded answer, but thank you for asking.
Fantastic. There's a question online from Covey. It says, isn't it self-centered to surround yourself, self-centric to surround yourself with good people? How do you think change comes about that way? And I think to that point, I would even elaborate and say, you speak a lot about connecting to the right people in the right way. And I actually, when we met in Fargo, North Dakota, last summer, that was the title of your TED Talk. And so there's this difference between just networking, and being around good people and really bringing in some contextual knowledge around that to do it in a context sensitive way. You talk about, I think, the difference between networking and relationship building, which are two different things. It's not just like, hey, I have your card, I have your email, and you have mine. Right. So how, you know, can you speak a little bit more about, well, A, to Covey's question, you know, what is the power of surrounding yourself with good people? And B, to really speak a little bit more about, it's not just surrounding yourself or having these light relationships, but having context-dependent, rich, deep ties that you're talking about.
Yep, that's a wonderful question. And you're, Covey, you're 100% correct. All these things can be played out in a very narcissistic, self-absorbed sort of way. That so I think your question is a really good, challenging one. And it sort of calls upon each of us to think about how do we really answer these questions for ourselves in a way that isn't just self-serving. We, giving back, philanthropy, whatever you want to call it, can practice one way, be one of the most narcissistic, self-serving acts you can possibly do. And done in another way, it can be one of the most giving, compassionate, wonderful things that we can do with our lives. So how we practice that does matter. And when I say surround yourself with good people, I guess what I would say is this. I think that a couple of things. One, don't just surround yourself with people that like only make you happy, only make you feel good. If you, one of the third chapters about how do you, are you willing to go through hard places? And part of what I'm trying to say there and starts to respond to your question is you also need to connect people around you that challenge you and people that are not like yourself. And you need to get out into a community. And if you want to be a part of change, you can't just do it from afar. You have to literally get into a community and get to know people and get to know people unlike yourselves and to see the world differently than you see it. And that can be really uncomfortable and that can be really hard. So I think the notion of connecting is not just about connecting for your own sake. It's not just about connecting with people that make you feel good or the people that are like yourselves. It's connecting to people that give you a more holistic, as you said, Nipun, view of the world, give you a much more challenging view of yourself and how you play a part in the world. So that's a wonderful question. But the notion of connecting is, to your point, it isn't just, it is not a transactional thing. It's a relational thing. It's not a one-off thing. It's a constant thing. It's not meant to connote that I do it in ways that I know will serve myself and that when I make a connection, I know what the return is going to be. The value in connecting a lot of times is just connecting just to do it. You don't know where it's going to turn out. A lot of times there will be no payback for you. But I did this as a sort of a professional necessity originally in the course of the kind of work that I do. But I quickly, or not quickly, over time what I learned was you just need to start connecting to people a lot, even when you have no idea what the heck's going to happen. And 99 out of 100 connection may not mean anything. And it's the 100th one that's going to make a huge difference in your life in 5 years in a way that you never have any idea is going to make a difference. Mm-hmm. And you have to have a faith in the power of connection. Again, not only a lot of times not knowing the return, not knowing what's going to give to you. And in fact, a lot of times not going to give anything to you. After I did that enough, the two really wonderful things that would start to happen. One is 3 years later, I'd be in a meeting with four people and they would say they found each other. They got connected because of something I did with one of those people. I can't even remember what the hell I did. right? But somewhere down the road, it made a difference for somebody. And it took 79 connections that meant nothing, and the 80th one's the one that created something that happened. And that's such a wonderful payoff that, you know, we all have the chance to create, if we'll sort of think in that connecting sort of way. A self-serving, I guess, if you will, way that it's mattered to me is there's been a few opportunities I've been a part of in the last few years of my life that happened to me and for me because of connections I made to people many years ago that connected to someone else that eventually came back around to me. So I think connecting is a practice. It's a habit. It's hopefully a way of living life. And it's not just about surrounding yourself with happy things and people like yourself. It's about trying to get yourself more connected to the world in relational, not transactional ways, and believing and knowing that in the long term, that sense of connectedness is what really creates value, not just for yourself, but for your community and for the world around you. It's a wonderful question. I could probably spend the entire hour and a half on that one.
That's beautiful.
Hi, this is John in California.
Hi, John. Can you speak up just a little bit?
Yes. Can you hear me better now?
Yeah. That's great. Thank you.
Okay, good. Yeah, my question is this. Once you identify a social problem that you feel strongly about, I'm just wondering how you come up with a specific plan to address it when it seems like such a huge problem. And I'll give you an example. One of the things that really bothers me is the pharmaceutical industry does its best to convince the public that if you have an issue, I'll just give an example, high blood pressure, then you must take the latest drug to address it, versus using evidence-based non-pharmaceutical options, whether they might be plant-based diet or, you know, hibiscus tea or ground flaxseed. All of these things are in medical journals. There are a lot of studies that are randomized with controls, you know, good research methodology. I'm sure the pharmaceutical companies know about this, but the public never hears about it. You only see all the ads. So I'm just wondering how you go about addressing something that huge when you're up against an industry spending hundreds of millions of dollars. It's overwhelming.
Well, first of all, you might want to take on an easier one to start with. I'm just kidding. You know what, John? It's a great question. I'm going to give you an honest answer, which is, and this is the way I would have approached it with lots of folks that I talk with and have worked with over the last 17 years. First thing I'm going to tell you is send me a note. I gave you my contact info earlier, and just ask me that question again, because I don't know the answer, but what I do believe is I can help you find the answer. So part of my answer, sort of generic to the folks, are a lot of us don't know how to approach a challenge. And you identified a pretty high mountain there, right? Because you are correct. There's hundreds of millions, and they got a whole lot of reasons to have people believe a particular answer to a challenge in their life. But you know, we all know answers of, we all know little examples in the world where people have, you know, sort of taken on the giant entity, the giant corporation, and made a difference. I don't know how to go after this one, but what I do believe is that I can help you find a few positive, important ways to start. So my answer to you is the same I would give to other folks, which is I don't know right now, but send me a note and let's sort of, you know, do our connecting thing, do our networking thing, and I will try to help you find a few of the right places and the right people to get connected to get started.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
You bet.
Thanks. And how do you keep up, Paul, with all – we're going to send your email out to everyone who has RSVP'd on the call as well. But how do you – what's your secret of keeping up with all the responses you must be getting from social media, email, phones, you name it?
I don't know if that's part of our that's part of the agenda for the day, but
can't not do. I have to respond to all of them.
Correct. I'll tell you what. Actually, you know what the honest answer is. This is a sort of off topic in a way, but one of the things I learned through working at Microsoft, I had a boss that said one of the ways to not let this stuff get behind you is when you open the damn thing, deal with it, and So as opposed to having opening the same thing seven times and thinking about it, I wait until I'm ready and I sit down, I open it, I think about it, I deal with it, and I move on. I think that's a lot more efficient way. And I don't know, I get lots of emails that haven't yet. And I also try to clean it out at the end of every day. They never sort of overwhelm me yet. So maybe at some point in time I'll get too inundated. But as it is, dealing with it and not sort of opening it and having 632 unread emails in our inbox, or 487 we've opened we haven't dealt with, I think that's when the problem comes. So open it, deal with it, move on.
That's great. That's great. We have two comments online. I'm just going to read them. One is just a share, and the other is a question. This is Sarah Wilson from Washington. She says, 2 points. One, I knew I had to pursue getting my employer to address the gender-based pay equities by whatever legal means available. It took 6.5 years, 1986 to 1992.
Wow.
And she did it. And number two, I can't not do the Grasshopper Festival and the Grasshopper Growers and Catchers Projects for Unity Food Security and Economics, so which is, she's just sharing her inspiration, something she's doing.
Love
now.
It.
So that's great. And we have a question from Mark, who shares that, you know, this is a quote, a question long brewing within me is, how do we invite and inspire more neighbors around the planet to open their hearts wide enough that they can't not do their own deep inner calling and contribution to deepening, growing, and nourishing themselves in the world? So how do you inspire your neighbors to can't not do?
Ooh, boy, that's a really simple but hard question. You know, I guess in a way I had a built-in neighborhood that was called FCP. But if I think about, and that gives me a certain context in which to do the work, and that helps. But I guess what I would say is that the way that we created that neighborhood was one connection at a time. That probably sounds almost corny. There's a woman named Meg Wheatley. If you Google her and some of her work, she's very good at talking, I think, about how people connecting eventually can lead to creating a sense of community. And part of her message that I believe in, just like I believe about the general idea of can't do in general, is I don't, you know, how do you create a neighborhood that feels this way? The best way that I know is to start one person at a time and, you know, sort of put yourself out there. There's a little bit of vulnerability to that. There's some fear to that to overcome. You know, you don't need to, like, you know, drop your whole life story in the middle of the street and hope nobody runs over it. But there's certainly a way of probably reaching out to somebody, some one person, and just opening the conversation and saying, here's what I'm thinking. And maybe you'll do that with five neighbors, and three of them could care less. Two of them will care. And now you don't have one, you got three. So I think maybe, hopefully one thought is, don't try to think about the neighborhood. Don't try to think about the mountaintop. Think about the first step in the journey, as we've heard many times. Find the first couple connections. And when there's three of you, you have a very different thing going on than when it's just one of you. And see if you can find, heck, when you got two, that's a lot better than one, right? When you got three, that's better than two. And I think that's the way things do start, is one, two, three. Then at some point you get to the time where you can start to do multiplication instead of just addition. But I'd say start with one person and see what starting the conversation and bringing your own sense of vulnerability to the degree that it feels okay to you, but bringing that to the conversation and see what happens.
Awesome. Paul, this is Amit again. You know, this has just been an incredible call. You really, you know, shed some light on so many different areas, and so I wouldn't even know where to begin. But it also brought up another question in me, and, you know, this is something that we often talk about within service space, about the importance of inner transformation. And so while we're out there making, you know, trying to make a change in the, you know, in the world, you know, what are we doing to really change ourselves? And that being sort of a core pillar around, you know, how some of us try to lead our lives. And so I'm curious, you know, your take on this idea of inner transformation and how you've been transformed over the last 17 years, 18 years, working with so many wonderful people and organizations.
Yep. It's a great question. It's a very chicken and egg sort of question. And my, I think everybody's probably got a personal sort of take on this. Mine would be this, that I think how each of us thinks about that sort of depends on what's maybe going on in your life. I do believe in the idea that if you are not positive about yourself inside, it's hard for you to go out and help the world outside in a authentic, powerful way. You've got to be happy inside. The way you get to that, sometimes for some of us, is probably how we live our own life, how we, you know, think about ourselves, how we deal with things inside of ourselves. For other folks, and I think I'm more often this way than that way, the way to deepen my own self and grow my own self is to get outside myself and to get out in the world. And one of the most powerful ways for me to build my own sense of inner strength is to go help other people try to build theirs. You know, one of the most powerful ways for me to live a better life is to go help other, give my life away, go help other people. So for some folks, I think that process is inside out. And for other folks, the process is outside in. And I don't think either one's better than the other one. I think it's probably different for different people. It's probably different for each of us at different stages in our life. And maybe at particular points in time, inside out makes more sense. And other times, outside in makes more sense. But that's just sort of a way maybe to think about it. And I know for me in my life, more often get outside is a more powerful way to change who I am inside.
Wonderful. You know, one of the things that we like to ask all of our callers is what can we as the service-based community do for you or the work that you're doing today?
Wow, what a wonderful question. You've done it. You've invited me along for an hour and a half to have a conversation with you guys and to share it with whoever's on the phone, and hopefully a handful of folks that will write to me. Something more will happen from that. So, you know, you've done it. I'm very appreciative of it. You guys know about what I'm up to. I know about what you're up to. We're definitely kindred spirits. And I think just by doing this and having this conversation, we hopefully reach, you know, at least one more person and help one more person sort of be ready to take that next step in life. So you've done it, Amit and Nipun, by inviting me in this morning. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah, and thank you. This is certainly there's still a bunch of comments coming in. Someone just wrote in from Kindspring and talked about how this call reminded them of small acts of kindness, and you know, all your comments from transactional to relationship, from one-off to constant, from just do it to can't not do it. You know, I think these are all things that will stay with us. We've featured your, you know, we featured you on Daily Good earlier this week. We've been live tweeting some of the things here, and like you said, since you're comfortable, we're going to be sharing your email with all the callers here today,
Please do.
The folks that have RSVP'd. And so we really appreciate all this. And you are, you know, we talk a lot in service space about the ripple effect, and that you do your little bit, and you never know where that's going to go. And you sort of live that in so many different ways. And thank you for bringing that spirit on this call and to our community in so many ways. So thank you so much.
Thank you, and thanks to everybody listening in.
Yeah, and we before we end, what we like to do is just, again, do a collective minute of silence in gratitude. And I just want to also mention all the people behind the scenes who make all kinds of things possible around these calls. Thank you to all the callers as well, and all the listeners. We will, after that minute of silence, we'll open up all the lines and we'll try to do one of these wonderfully chaotic thank you. So we'll all like yell out 1, 2, 3, and then we'll all say thank you, Paul. But before we get to that, let's do a minute of silence. Thank you all for co-creating this space today. Thank you all. As we were doing this, we just got one last comment in from Melissa McGuire from Michigan. She says, Paul, thank you so much for your time and inspiration. Everyone's work who put all this together, keep up the great work. I enjoyed my first call so much. I can't wait to implement some of your, which is Paul's, advice into my work, and look forward to learning more. So I think Melissa really echoes a lot of what many of us are feeling. So thank you all. And as we promised, I'm going to take everybody, at least all the folks that are on the phone lines, off of mute, and I'm going to count to three, and then we can all just say our chaotic thank yous to Paul here. So one, two, and three.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you so much.
Thank you all so much. Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Thank you for listening to a recording of Awaken Calls. To access archives, visit us at www.awaken.org. And to get more involved, volunteer at www.servicespace.org.